The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, gender-inclusive drug policies. The UN General Assembly opened its 80th session on September 9th of this year. 2025 also marks the 30th anniversary of the Fourth World Conference on Women and the adoption of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action. A number of events and discussions are being held at the UN to mark these occasions. One of these events, held September 22nd at the UN in New York City, is the subject of this week's show. Entitled, Towards a Gender-Inclusive Drug Policy, Beijing Plus 30, this high-level side event shone a bright light on how discriminatory drug laws harm women's health, fuel incarceration, and deepen inequality. It also focused on how gender-responsive, rights-based reforms can repair those harms and drive progress toward a better future. We start our coverage with introductory remarks on that panel by Arlene B. Tickner, at-large ambassador for gender affairs and global feminist policy at the Colombian Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
It's a great pleasure for me to be here on behalf of the government of Colombia and to join our partners in this conversation. This is a much needed discussion about the intersection between drug policies, gender perspectives, and human rights. And we hope to continue contributing with our voice and our actions from the government of Colombia to the advancement of this agenda. We celebrate the fact that health as a fundamental and universal right is at the center of the conversation, but we would also like to note that it's not enough to recognize this in multilateral spaces such as this one. We need to ensure that these principles are translated into concrete, effective, and sustainable public policies. In this context, it seems essential to remind ourselves that the effective realization of women's right to health can't be separate from a thorough review of drug policies. In the context of the 30th anniversary of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action, we're calling for an approach we are calling for this to be integrated into discussions on gender equality. Drug control policies, particularly those of a punitive nature, which are the norm, have had a differentiated and disproportionate impact on women and LGBTIQ plus persons, directly affecting their physical, mental, and reproductive health, as well as their access to treatment, protection from violence, and social participation. The 2025 World Drug Report clearly reflects this gap. In 2023, only 1 in 18 women with problematic drug use accessed treatment, compared to 1 in 7 men. Similarly, women who inject drugs are 1.2 times more likely than men to be living with HIV, which highlights their greater exposure to health and social risks exacerbated by the lack of adequate and gender-sensitive services. The High Commissioner for Human Rights was adamant in 2023 in highlighting the human rights challenges to addressing and countering all aspects of the world drug problem, and I quote, "Women who use drugs also face significant stigma and discrimination in accessing harm reduction programs, drug dependence treatment, and basic health care." Along the same lines, the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, in her reports published just this year, has documented that women who use drugs are exposed to rates of violence up to 42 times higher than those who do not use substances. She's also pointed out that harm reduction services are often designed without considering gender differences and are disconnected from comprehensive responses to violence and sexual and reproductive health. In the Beijing Declaration and Platform to Action, we've committed to eliminating structural barriers to equality. Even though the text doesn't mention it explicitly, the evidence shows that gender-sensitive policy responses in drug-related matters are a must for attaining the objectives and goals set forth in Beijing 30 years ago. It's time to address this void. I want to speak just 1 second about the steps that my government has taken, in particular through the adoption of a public utility law that seeks to ensure that vulnerable women, heads of family convicted of drug-related crimes, receive alternative restorative sanctions in and via community service. This is one of the first laws in the world to consider care responsibilities when sanctions are applied, and we think it's a potential model for Latin America and the Caribbean, if not the world. given in particular the dramatic rise in prison populations of women who are impoverished most of the time and in vulnerable situations. Current drug control frameworks and their punitive approach have failed to protect women. On the contrary, they've deepened inequalities, fueled stigmatization, and perpetuated cycles of exclusion and violence. I would also add that they've exacerbated what we could call the criminalization of feminine poverty. Women who use substances, particularly those living in poverty, who are racialized or who belong to historically marginalized communities, face multiple barriers to exercising their right to health. They're denied access to comprehensive services, criminalized, subjugated, and separated from their children. Instead of being addressed from a public health and rights perspective, substance abuse has become a justification for further violating their rights. We can't continue to talk about gender equality without tackling the limitations of the international drug regime. From Colombia, we recognize our multiple challenges in this regard, inside our country as well, but we also reaffirm our commitment to a drug policy that integrates a gender perspective, listens to the women affected, and ends punishment as the main response. This is our motivation in including gender as one of the pillars of our foreign policy approach to drugs and our feminist foreign policy, and to promote initiatives such as the resolution currently before the Human Rights Council in Geneva, which requests the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights to prepare a report on the impact of drug policies on women's rights. The transformation we need, and on this I'll end, can't be delayed any longer. The lives, health, and well-being of hundreds of thousands of women are at stake, and this risk continues to be aggravated in the current context of shrinking funding and political backlash. And so I think we need to reinvigorate our efforts to introduce this issue into the conversation about women's rights and gender equality. I thank you.
That was Arlene B. Tickner, at-large ambassador for gender affairs and global feminist policy at the Colombian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. She was speaking on a panel entitled Towards a Gender-Inclusive Drug Policy, Beijing Plus 30, which was held September 22nd at the United Nations. Let's hear another speaker from that event. Christine Stegling is Deputy Executive Director of the Policy, Advocacy, and Knowledge Branch at UNAIDS.
I'm delighted to speak to an issue that remains inconvenient and unacceptable. HIV continues to disproportionately affect women who use drugs, women who are incarcerated or experience multiple overlapping vulnerabilities. And I think we have already started talking about that. And that is, despite global commitments, these women remain underreached, they remain underserved, and they remain over-stigmatized. Women who use drugs and or are incarcerated face overlapping vulnerabilities. Risk of HIV acquisition via injecting drug use, via unprotected sex, but also transactional sex, and major barriers in accessing HIV prevention, treatment, and care due to stigma and discrimination, due to gender-based violence, and due to gender-based violence. So let me start with a couple of, or a few realities and figures. Prisons are high-risk environments for drug use and infectious disease transmission. Prisons and other closed settings have a high prevalence of HIV, hepatitis B and C, and tuberculosis. Drug use and drug use disorders are often higher in prison than in the general population. More men than women use drugs, but women face greater harm and greater stigma. Nearly one in five people who inject drugs experience an overdose annually, with heightened risk following prison release or opioid withdrawal. Women in prison have up to 15 times higher HIV prevalence than non-incarcerated women. Resources for treatment, care, and recovery support are limited, and treatment remains out of reach for most, and especially for women. People in prisons and other closed settings are still routinely neglected in HIV prevention programs, and in particular, harm reduction programs. Again, we've already noted that. Harm reduction programs are even rarer for people in prisons and other closed settings. So it's all about bridging the gap between global commitments and the realities of women's access to HIV prevention, treatment, and care, particularly for women who use drugs and or are incarcerated, requiring a shift from high-level policy declarations to sustained ground-level implementation, focus on equity, accountability, and structural change. We have many of those declarations, global strategies like the Global AIDS Strategy 2021 to 2026 and the Political Declaration on HIV and AIDS 2021 are committing to eliminating inequities. And we are preparing now for the new Global AIDS strategy for 2026 to 2031 and the high-level meeting and political declaration in June 2026. And as we do this, we must strive to reduce the gap between these high-level commitments and the lived realities on the ground, which are wide and which are growing. So to close, we must act and follow on several fronts. We must decriminalize drug use and sex work. Criminalization fuels stigma, prevents access to services, and drives women underground. We know that countries with decriminalization models see higher rates of service uptake and lower HIV incidence. We must scale up gender-specific trauma-informed care. Services must reflect the realities of women's lives, including childcare, gender-based violence, and reproductive health. Third, we must invest in peer-led and community-based service delivery. Funding must go to women with lived experiences, those best positioned to reach others and design culturally appropriate solutions. Fourth, we need to strengthen data systems and accountability. We require data gender disaggregated key population specific HIV indicators, including for incarcerated women and women who use drugs. And we need to ensure continuity of care across justice and health systems, which is really important and is one of the things the Joint Program on HIV is here to do, to design a multi-sectoral response to HIV, because we know it is not just a health sector response. So to end AIDS as a public health threat by 2030, which remains our goal, we need evidence-based public health and human rights approaches that work for everyone. The path forward is not just theory, it's practical, proven, and possible. And what is needed now is not more global declarations, but scaling up what we know works for women who use drugs, women in prison, and women living with HIV. Let us start investing in these solutions that already exist, and let this conversation be part of that path that we're taking. So with that, I thank you.
That was Christine Stegling, Deputy Executive Director of the Policy, Advocacy, and Knowledge Branch at UNAIDS. She was speaking on a panel entitled Towards a Gender-Inclusive Drug Policy, Beijing Plus 30, which was held September 22nd at the United Nations. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear more speakers from that event. Cassandra Frederick is Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance.
Scholars have long named that drugs are used as a regulatory technology to control and conduct the subjectivities of women and other marginalized groups. Internationalist feminist and drug user advocate and organizer Judy Chang has pointed out patriarchy and drug prohibition are predicated on the same objectives and principles, the suppression and subjugation of difference, the control of bodies, the limitations on personal choice and freedom, and the silencing of dissenting voices. In fact, society and governments have used women and tropes about motherhood to drive moral panics. Crack babies in the U.S., grieving mothers who've lost their children to overdose or drug-related violence, in turn to justify the destructive policies that I will describe today, systems of criminalization. The drug war is a major driver of criminalization, as we heard, of women across the globe, and deepens structural inequality. 35% of incarcerated women around the world, nearly 60% of incarcerated women in Peru and the Philippines, and 46% of incarcerated women in Colombia were convicted of drug-related offenses. And we see how the war on drugs is bolstering rising authoritarianism, from militarized policing in urban areas to border enforcement to detention and deportation to extrajudicial killings. Drug war logic permeates. The impact of stigma and criminalization is especially hard on pregnant and parenting people. Drug war logic permeates our systems, convincing us that people who use drugs, especially women, are undeserving of care and worthy of punishment. We only have to look at the ways in which different governments have modeled their rhetoric and policies to understand how we've created a class of people deemed subhuman. Fears around drugs and parenting have been the fuel for the fire. Mandated reporting, family separation, prenatal and parent testing. In some places in the U.S., Black women are 9 times more likely to experience non-consensual drug testing during prenatal visits or delivery than white women, and experience high rates of family policing and separation due to actual or perceived drug use. Forced sterilization, sterilization without consent. The global ramifications of U.S.-driven drug war around the world are equally, if not more devastatingly, fueling violence, targeting Black, Indigenous, and other women and trans people of color in the Caribbean, in Central and South America, and of course at the U.S.-Mexico border. This is on top of structural inequity, social and political exclusion, and women's vulnerabilities to violence and coercion. Women and girls are more likely to live in poverty and are more vulnerable to coercion and violence, including things like partner violence, which we just heard from the ambassador of Colombia, police violence especially. Women are often charged with taking the rap for partners who commit drug crimes. So when they cannot get to men, they force themselves to target women. We are more susceptible to being pressured to have unprotected sex and or sharing needles, STIs, bloodborne diseases, a lot of the things that the person from the UNAIDS was talking about. And in the U.S., drug convictions are used to deny access to housing and public benefits, worsening systems of economic inequality. This infrastructure of policies are used as systematic divestment in communities and the kinds of infrastructure and services that make life livable. Healthcare, employment, education, and it continues to exacerbate the structural inequities that women also continue to face. And then when women need help, when they've decided that they are struggling with drug use, they experience barriers to care. When women and girls have drug problems, they face all kinds of issues. The treatment programs don't accommodate parenting. The financial barriers are even higher. And the modalities that are used are based on research on men. And so we know that drug use for women can be different, and we know that the research shows that the treatment should be different, but it is not different because so much of the research and supports are based on men. And when women do need medication for drugs, they are less likely to get pain medication, especially poor women, women of color, are often seen as drug seeking, and they are less likely to get access to supports. And in the U.S., in the context of the criminalization of healthcare, particularly we are seeing the web of criminalization in terms of the mounting criminalization around abortion and gender-affirming care.
That was Cassandra Frederick, Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. She was speaking on a panel entitled Towards a Gender-Inclusive Drug Policy, Beijing Plus 30, which was held September 22nd at the United Nations. Another speaker on the panel was Mandeep Dhaliwal, Director of the HIV and Health Group at the UN Development Program.
I was reflecting today that UNDP has been focusing on the development dimensions of drug policy since 2015, when we published our first paper framing the issue of drugs as an issue of sustainable development. In that 2015 paper, we highlighted the importance of gender issues in the context of drug policy and the context of sustainable development. We talked about the vulnerability, increased vulnerability and risk to women. We talked about punitive and gender-blind drug policies deepening inequities. Women who use drugs face double, triple, multiple forms of stigma. As women who are drug users, trans women or sex workers who use drugs, women who are incarcerated, the stigma is layered and multifold. So the solutions also need to be multi-sectoral and deeper rather than simple sector-specific solutions. And I wanted to, the question was health systems, and the first note I scribbled down was, well, you can't have a health system without community systems. And we've learned that very powerfully in HIV, that a health system stops at a certain place. The work that is carried on beyond that comes from the communities. And the most effective interventions, support in prevention, treatment, care come from the most affected communities. So I think we need to think about how we more meaningfully engage women who use drugs, whether they are trans women, whether they are sex workers, whether they're incarcerated, whether they're mothers or supporting their families. How do we include them in the systems that are reducing their vulnerability and reducing risk? That's an important part of the solution. You know, I could spend a lot of time outlining the evidence of harm, but I think you know, we'll hear that, we'll talk, and many of the speakers have highlighted that. But I really want to highlight a couple of specific populations, indigenous communities, women and rural cultivators, who are disproportionately affected by the so-called war on drugs. And again, I'll refer you to our 2015 paper and the paper we just released on Wednesday, the 17th of September, looking at sort of the newer sort of issues, emerging issues and opportunities in terms of the development dimensions of drug policy. We know that women in communities face violence from organized crime groups, but also often from government-led eradication efforts, which undermine livelihoods and deepen the cycles of poverty and exclusion. For example, some coca eradication programs in the Andean region have often destroyed the subsistence crops of rural women farmers while offering few viable economic alternatives. Since 2000, the female prison population has grown by 66%, far outpacing that of men, which is at 20%. In Cambodia, the female prison population has risen ninefold since 2020, with 60% of convictions being drug-related. Similar patterns are seen in Indonesia, Brazil, and Colombia. So what works? We know what works. There has been years of evidence that decriminalization of drug use for personal use and lower level offenses is critical to reducing stigma and discrimination and enabling women to access services. Colombia's 2023 law providing community sentences for women heads of household and Mexico's 2020 amnesty law for vulnerable populations show how legal reform can address the disproportionate impact on women. Brazil has started a rights-based program for marginalized groups, including indigenous and Afro-Brazilian communities, which programs have also, and these programs also have a gender lens. Gender-sensitive alternative development programs can empower women by increasing access to land, credit, decision-making roles, and challenging harmful gender norms. There are numerous examples of gender-sensitive services for women who use drugs in the global north. Australia, Spain, the United Kingdom. Also, we're seeing promising initiatives from the Global South. In Nepal, the Global Fund supported female-only drop-in centers and needle and syringe programs show how simple design changes, safe spaces, childcare, and women's staff unlock access for women who use drugs. In Kenya, integrated medication-assisted treatment clinics combine opioid therapy with HIV services, sexual and reproductive health care, and hepatitis treatment. And when tailored for women, uptake and retention improves. So we need integrated and gender-responsive services. Health and community systems must respond to women's specific realities. One of the best ways to do that is really by including women and the most vulnerable women in these programs. And the final thing I just want to say is that, you know, Lopa, coming back to your introduction, if we're really serious about deepening and driving progress in line with Beijing commitments and SDGs, we need to really dismantle these punitive and discriminatory laws and scale gender-responsive services and invest in women and community-led solutions.
That was Mandeep Dhaliwal, director of the HIV and Health Group at the UN Development Program. One more speaker from that event while we still have time. Gabriela Mardero is First Secretary, Gender and Humanitarian Affairs at the Permanent Mission of Mexico to the United Nations.
If drug policies are well-crafted, they can reach the core of our social fabric and help reweave it through a more human lens. For decades, we have waged an ineffective war on drugs rooted in oversimplistic premises of how to fix systemic issues. This has become more of a war on our people. And when I say our people, we know it does not affect our entire populations equally. It hits those who are historically marginalized the hardest. As we analyze such correlation, we must start with half of the world's population, which has been deliberately excluded for centuries. We must say it loud and clear, especially in a day like today that we are celebrating here at the General Assembly, the anniversary of the Beijing Declaration. Women bear the brunt of our deficiencies as governments. The deficiencies of our drug policies. And also, we bear the brunt of our stubbornness to not to seek a better course of action and of the blind eye we turned to our failed methodologies. Evidence is abundant. As Cassandra and Christine and Ambassador Tickner has also shared with us, the data and the facts and the evidence is there what are we going to do as member states and as an international organization to tackle this problem for half of the population of this world? We cannot say that we are lacking facts and information, but what we are lacking is reforms, gender responsive, and even gender transformative policies. Otherwise, it's just papers and works and meetings and things that honestly go nowhere and that are not serving women and girls and children in general, because we all know the impact that imprisoning a woman means for the entire family and the entire social fabric. Since many countries are still lacking, including mine, we're building it, are lacking proper care systems, care and support systems. We can imagine what happens when a woman goes to prison with their kids, and it's not her, the only one who suffers is all the people that she takes care of. And considering that 70% of the care work is performed by women and girls, then it's obvious. Obviously, it's not going to be good in 10 years, in 15 years. It's not just the moment when this happens. It's throughout the life course of people. So we must acknowledge that there have been also some steps in the right direction. Internationally, the Bangkok rules have provided an important framework for non-custodial measures and prioritizing social reintegration for women. We have also seen some compelling efforts at country level. Like in Mexico, as was mentioned previously, we have adopted legislative reforms that provide pathways to amnesty for women and groups in vulnerable situations, with a view to mitigating the disproportionate impact of incarceration for minor drug offenses. Colombia, a partner that we greatly value in this endeavor to transform global drug policy, has provided women who are heads of family the opportunity to substitute prison sentences with community services. In Mexico, that we are we now have our first female president in over two centuries of national history, we can be very sure that the next steps will have purple feminist lenses in this matter, and we are very 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 proud of that. Not just in drug policies in the times to come, but also in the care system, the care and support system buildings.
That was Gabriela Mardero, First Secretary of Gender and Humanitarian Affairs at the Permanent Mission of Mexico to the United Nations. She was speaking on a panel entitled Towards a Gender-Inclusive Drug Policy, Beijing Plus 30, which was held September 22nd at the United Nations to mark the 80th session of the United Nations and the 30th anniversary of the Fourth World Conference on Women and the adoption of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policies and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
So long!
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.